This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 91-year-old John Durant, a native of Massachusetts who makes his home in California now. Our visit today is timely as people around the world are marking 70 years since the Berlin airlift, that humanitarian triumph that seven decades ago kept West Berlin free by overcoming a ground blockade and restricted airspace, delivering over 1,500 tons of food per day, not to mention 3,500 tons of coal for daily energy. One of the most well-known characters of that airlift, Gail Halvorsen, is reenacting his candy bomber drill again this weekend in Spanish Fork, Utah, in honor of the 70th anniversary. He's shared his story on this program in the past, and you can find it at hometownheroesradio.com. Look for episode number 404. As for John Durant, he'd been working at the 45th Air Depot in France, but after World War II came to a close, a move, which would prove quite fateful in multiple ways, was in order.
The war ended. We moved there. Now, I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The French said, thank you, guys, now get out. We had to move our base down to Germany. So we went down there, found a base outside of Frankfurt. The Germans were still working there. The pilots all gone home, but the guys were working, you know, maintenance of the buildings. So we took it over and hired the same guys to maintain the buildings, and I became in charge of the electric shop. Hey, I'm a 17-year-old kid. I'm in charge of electric. See, the point system happened where you got a point for every month you were there. You got a point for every mission. You got 3 points for being wounded and all this stuff. These guys had 60, 70, 80 points. They're going home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm staying there. They're going home. Pretty soon, I'm the only guy left. I'm in charge of the electric shop. And I had to maintain all the buildings. Also had to maintain planes in a hangar. And pretty soon, we had new guys come in from the States. We moved our whole outfit down there. What we were the collection point, one of the collection points for Air Force Special Purpose vehicles after the war. We picked up about 1,000 airplanes. We picked up gas trailers, gas trucks, tree tracks, the tugs, and all the vehicles you maintain airport. We had 5,000 of those things. Had to transport them down to Germany on trailers, two at a time. Everybody drove 190 guys. We all drove. That's all we did is drive. We drove for 6 months to bring those stuff all down to Germany. That was an adventure.
Well, and I hope people caught what you said there, because I know some people are familiar with the end of the war. You know, America and the USSR would both love to take the top German brains, and America ended up getting a lot of them in Operation Paperclip. But you're saying that where you ended up at that base, the same guys who a month before were working on ME-109s and FW-190s, all the German planes, are now working on American planes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
How about that?
It took a while because initially they only wanted the German people to be janitors. And some of us knew a little better, never said a word, but we had them work on other stuff. And it wasn't until a couple of years before they finally approved all this.
Hmm.
We had them working on everything.
And how did you get along? I mean, you guys have just been enemies.
Got along fine. You know, the war's over. The war's over. We got a job to do. Let's do it. Yeah, I made a lot of friends over there. A lot of wonderful people. One of my surprises was we were victims of the propaganda. All the Germans are Nazis. They're all pigs. They all want to kill everybody. You get over there, and you know, after about maybe a month and a half, you get invited to one of these guys' homes on a Sunday afternoon. They're having coffee with neighbors, and they got a house, and they got a garden, and they got a dog. You look around and say, they're just like us.
Hmm.
What a shock this is, because we were taught otherwise. And that's part of the shame of this whole thing, you know. We're still over there. Let me tell you more about that. When the war was over, we went down to Germany, late 1945, 46. The State Department was over there in force because what we were trying to do was get the German economy started again. We weren't over there to occupy and persecute these people. We were over there to get the economy started. The war was over. The heads really knew what was going on. They were trying to get the farms operating again. What they did, they used up all their seeds. They sent shiploads of seeds over, and since we had trucks, I was delivering seeds to the farmers in February and March of 1946 so they get their farm started again. One guy I ran into, he says, that's fine, but he says, my electric motor's broke for my pump. But 2 weeks later, I ran to electric motor, I brought it to him. They're still friends. Old man's gone, but the kids are still I go over there and I visit them, I still do. They were, like I say, we were victims of a lot of propaganda. The German people are terrible people. 10 or 15% were Nazis, yeah, but the rest of them just wanted the peace. I just want to have my family life and my job. It's a wonderful country.
Well, I want to get to the airlift, but a couple other questions come to mind. Because here you are, a wide-eyed teenager taking all this in. What about when Germany surrendered, when VE Day came around? Was that a significant day for you guys?
Oh, yeah. Big whoop-de-doo. Yeah, VE Day. Oh, big whoop-de-doo. Yeah, that was incredible. The war was over, you know. There's more to that story. All the guys, like I say, were going home. Well, I was still there. I just got there, and I found out I'm on the list to go to Japan. That's where we were going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Enola Gay saved my life. Enola Gay is in the Udvar Hazy Museum at Dulles Airport. I've seen it a couple of times. You can almost reach it. And I sit there, and it brings tears to my eyes. Really. Mm. Incredible. That plane saved my life.
Because what would you have been doing if Truman hadn't made that decision to use atomic weaponry?
I'd have been working on airplanes over on Iwo Jima or one of those Tinian or one of those islands over there. I probably wouldn't have gotten to Japan, but the poor soldiers who had to invade that place, we would have lost 1 million men. They were fanatics. They weren't going to quit.
So because that happened and Japan surrendered, you stayed right there in Germany. And again, this is all still fresh. And roughly within a year, either way of that, is when people are learning and being made aware of what was happening in all these concentration camps throughout Nazi-held territory.
Yeah.
Do you remember finding out about that and what a shock to the system that must have been?
Well, I'll tell you what. I was in Munich in October, November 1945. Four of us got a Jeep. We're going to go up to Dachau. Got there, parked the Jeep, standing in front, in a big Dachau. You want to go in there? I don't know. You want to go in? I don't know. We turned around and went home. We couldn't make ourselves go in. Didn't want to see it. We knew what it was. You could smell it. We knew what it was. We just didn't know. I've never seen one of those concentrations. I don't want to. I don't want to see it.
Hmm.
Dachau was outside of Munich, about 35 miles northwest of Munich. It was easy to get to. We went up there and couldn't go in. Couldn't make ourselves go in.
I understand.
Terrible. Terrible situation.
So because you were so young and didn't have so many points, you get left there. You told us some of the duties you had in the interim, delivering seeds, gathering up all those vehicles, all those little things you're doing. And then you started to tell me about the airlift. And you gave me kind of the overview that General LeMay, the same Air Force or Army Air Corps leader at that time who had masterminded the B-29 bombings of Japan, he now comes up with this idea of the airlift or finds a way to make it happen. Where were you in that picture, and what did that mean for you and your work?
I was in a base in Munich called Erding Air Depot. That was 1948. Let me tell you why I stayed there. The old story, I met a girl.
Uh-huh.
Met a girl, decided, you know, well, this is the girl for me, so I extended and I reenlisted, and finally we got married. And we spent 66 years together. She just passed away 5 years ago. Most wonderful lady I've ever met in my life. Absolutely. Could not have find a better person to spend my life with. But that's why I stayed there. And, of course, we were supposed to come home in 1948. And 1948, June 26th, I go to work on, that was on a Saturday. I went Monday morning, and I work for a guy named LeMay. Not General LeMay. This is Major LeMay, okay? His older brother. And he says to me, he says, Durant, you got gas in your car? I said, yes, sir. He says, well, go up to the orderly room. They're cutting a set of orders for you right now. Bring it back. I'll sign them. You're going up to Frankfurt. They stopped all the Autobahn traffic and all the train traffic and barge traffic to Berlin. They need to fly stuff in. You go up there and look around and call me, tell me what else you need, and help me see what's going on. I get up there. I got this set of orders signed by LeMay. I give this add orders to the staff. So he brings them in. A mass sergeant comes out. I said, Colonel wants to see you. So I walk in and he says, who the hell are you? Staff Sergeant John Durant, sir. He says, how come he's got a set of orders signed by LeMay? Well, how do you tell a bull colonel he's reading the orders wrong? It wasn't Major General C.E. LeMay, okay? It was Major L.L. LeMay, okay? But you can easily miss it. Anyway, the point is, we got that straightened out. He says, what do you do for me? I said, well, I've been here for almost 4 years. I know where all the stuff is. Otherwise, nobody else knows. There's no central location where you can tell where the stuff is located. But I know where it is. I've been on inspection trips all over Europe. He said, besides that fact, I got a pilot's license. I got a ham's license. I got an apartment in Frankfurt. I'm not going to sleep in your tent. He says, I want you in my staff meetings. I'm the only staff sergeant in the staff meetings, okay? And now the funny part about this, we had a couple of colonels come over from the Pentagon. They're going to tell us how to run things. And one guy's upset there. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to only put enough gas in the C-54s to fly to Berlin and back with a safety factor. And I says, you can't do that. What do you mean you can't do that? I says, well, there's a tech order that says there's a limit to how much weight you can put in a C-54 if the tanks are not full. And if you don't, you're going to break the wings off, because the wings are made to flex here. They're not made to flex up there. Some guy says, yeah, he's right. Well, that colonel and I avoided him like the plague. He hated my ever-loving guts, because he's an Air Force colonel. You don't know this. You know, you're supposed to know this kind of stuff. Anyway, we got the flying airlift, and I was the gopher. I was the scrounger. I knew where all the stuff was. I was on the phone all the time, get stuff up here. You know, get truckloads of this, truckloads of tires, truckloads of engines, truckloads of windshield wipers, truckloads of spark plugs, truckloads of parts for the airplane. They were spread all over Europe. See, at the end of the war, all the four-engine planes flew home. People don't know this. The B-17s had a crew of 10. They had 10. They took 8 more guys with them who didn't want to wait for the Queen Mary. They didn't want to go home. So all the four-engine planes flew home. All the one-engine planes, the single-engine planes, the fighters and trainers stayed in Europe. They gave them all to Yugoslavia, to Poland, to Belgium, to Romania. And all the stuff was gone. When the Berlin airlift started in 48, we had 102 C-47s, two-engine planes, and we had two C-54s. One belonged to Clay. We weren't going to get that. One belonged to LeMay. We weren't going to get that one. So we started flying. See, they only carried two tons. The C-54s carried 10.5 tons. That was good.
And just a few years before, the Germans are your enemies and the Russians are your allies. Now, as that Iron Curtain is being firmly established and West Berlin is just this small little outpost of freedom there, this was a monumental mission to keep those people alive so West Berlin didn't turn into another part of East Berlin, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you guys aren't doing this and getting all those supplies to sustain the population of West Berlin, it's just going to be overrun, and that spread of communism is going to grow.
Sure.
Did you understand all that at the time?
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, sure. We were savvy. We knew what was going on.
Was it a little weird to be fighting the Russians all of a sudden?
Yeah, it was. It was, because Uncle Joe was our friend, you know, and we believed, okay, yeah, Uncle Joe's our friend, but he really wasn't. And we knew what was going on. It was getting tighter and tighter and tighter. The thing was, after the airlift started, really you could see the difference. You could walk into a Gasthaus in Germany, any place, put your hat on a table. By the time you got sit down, there were 3 beers in front of you. Those people really appreciated what we did and thanked us. When we came down into Germany, I had 3 women come up to me over the first 3 or 4 months, threw their arms around me, thank you for saving our lives, in German. I knew what they were saying because I was beginning to learn German. They knew what we were doing there. We didn't come there to conquer them. We came there to save their lives, and they knew it. It was an amazing transformation.
This starts in June of 48, as you say. It lasts all the way until May of 49. Were there times in there where there was a real fear or concern that an all-out war with the Soviets could ensue?
Oh, hell, that was a distinct possibility. See, we were flying into Berlin. They were harassing us with MiG-3s. They would fly right at us and peel off. One guy peeled off and came back and made another run and hit the C-47. They both crashed. The corridors were 15 miles wide, 10 miles the max altitude. They would erect barrage balloons with their wires. If you strayed off course, you'd hit a wire and you were dead. You had to be right on course all the time. There were 750 instances of their harassing us while we were flying into Berlin. I remember, we were flying around the clock.
Yeah.
Fog, ice, night, dark, whatever. We had a ground control approach, was able in Chicago in 1948 to land maybe a plane every 20 minutes. We were landing them in Berlin every 3 minutes. We had GC people over there, GCA people over there who were active in World War II. They went and found them and sent them over there. We had companies. We had Raytheon was over there. ITT was over there. General Electric was over there perfecting their ground control approach activities. And we had these guys out on the field, and they were our angels. They told us, to be more specific, flying into Berlin, the first thing you do is register with Berlin Tower. You flew right over Tempelhof. You went north to Wedding. You turned right. Another set of controllers took you over, took you down a downwind path. You turned on a short final. And on short final, the precision guy took you up. He would tell you, you're on course. Your altitude is okay. You're at 6,000 feet. You're 5 miles from the runway. Flaps 20. Speed 140. He would tell you, you're 1 degree off. Get the 273 again. Now you're 274. Get the 270. You're 50 feet low. Lower your rate of descent. You're over the fence. You should see the runway take over and land. That was how much precision there was going on. Those guys saved our lives every day.
Well, and for those 11 months that this is going on, did you ever find yourself wondering, how long can this go on? How long can we keep this up?
Never occurred to us. Now, you say 11 months. Remember that this thing, the Russians capitulated in May, but we flew till September.
Oh, good point.
We flew till September. We didn't trust them. And we wanted a stockpile. And so we flew into September 30th. That was the end of the airlift. Then I went home.
And what were you doing that whole time?
First of all, I was the scrounger, okay?
Yeah.
And then not too long, about a month later, 2 months later, I found myself on a roster. You're a crew chief. You're going to take over. I said, hey, I don't know anything about C-54. You know, about 47, only two more engines. We're going to send you down to Oberwiesenfeld for the depot for a week and study the tech orders, and you're it. So here I am, a young kid. I'm the crew chief. Crew chief was not that big a deal then, okay? The C-54 had a crew of five. There were pilot, co-pilot, engineer, radio operator, and navigator. Well, we didn't need the radio operator. Pilots did it. We didn't need the navigator because we did our own navigating. So there was just three of us. And I didn't have a place to sit. I sat on the floor and worked the flaps. There was no crew chief station like we have today. It was very, very primitive.
How many of those flights do you think you made?
147.
147 round trips to Berlin.
Yeah, round trips to Berlin, yeah.
And were those all the same? Was it all monotonous and boring? Or were there some unique situations that color your memories?
There was ice, and sometimes there was, the ices don't work, you know, you have to replace a fuse. There was cargo loading and unloading. I had to supervise the cargo and unloading. When we first got into Berlin, before it got really organized, you get out of the airplane, go into the terminal, get a cup of coffee, check the maps and so forth. After that, when Tanaka always said, no, you don't get out of the airplane. We'll come out to you. We'll bring you the coffee, bring you the map, bring you the clearance, and, you know, unload and take off and get out of here. So it became a very, very, very monotonous. Monotonous is not the right word. It became a continuous, organized effort. As he said, like drips of water dropping on a stone. We had great big maps with charts, you know, with progress, and there was competitions going on. We were flying more flights than Fosberg was, and we were flying more flights than Seller was, and we carried more cargo and all that jazz. So he really got us going. I got to tell you about this. We had Christmas over there. Bob Hope came over. Bob Hope hadn't made a trip for a couple of years, but he heard about the airlift. He's going to come over and celebrate the airlift. We brought Irving Berlin with him, brought some girls with him, and brought Stu Symington, the Secretary of Defense, and they're going to make a big deal in Berlin and Wiesbaden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about 2 weeks before that happened, Turner found out they're going to do this in downtown Berlin and downtown Wiesbaden. Now, our guys were from the States. They lived in tents on the airbase. They didn't have cars. There was no way to get to these places downtown. Turner raised, holy hell. I said, you're not going to tell us this is an airlift presentation. This has got nothing to do with the airlift. And he made them come out to the hangars and put on the shows at both Wiesbaden and in Tempelhof. That was an interesting story that doesn't get very widely publicized.
Did you enjoy that?
I didn't see it. I was either sleeping or flying. I never saw the show. Never saw the show.
So you missed it, but thanks to General Tunner, Willie the Whip, they called him, or Tunnage Tunner, those other servicemen did get to see the show. As for this show, we have more from the airlift to explore, plus the work you did with the space program in the decades that followed. Find photos of John Durant then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.